Christmas. It's great to be back with you. Some of you may know that I was in the Holy Land last week, actually up till Wednesday night, with 69 pilgrims, and we were traveling along, walking in the footsteps of Jesus and having an incredible experience just seeing the land and watching the stories of the Gospels and even the Old Testament come to life. So I encourage you to put it on your bucket list someday. It's an incredible, incredible experience. One of the highlights of our experience is I've gotten to know some Palestinian Christians over the last couple of years. In fact, the guides that we use are all Palestinian Christians, and we actually put everybody to bed one night and went out, and we went with our friends back to Bethlehem, which is in the West Bank, and we were there. We went to Manger Square, and there is the tree, the Christmas tree, that's lit in Manger Square. So let me show you a little picture here. So here's some of my friends that I made along the way that actually live in Bethlehem in the West Bank, Palestinian Christians. And right behind there, you see this spire. That is the Church of the Nativity. So that's the church that was built over the grotto or the cave, that we have really solid evidence that that's where Mary gave birth to Jesus. And so here's a picture of our group actually inside the cave, looking at the place where Mary gave birth to Jesus. And everybody in here sounded beautiful, singing, "Oh, come all ye faithful, come let us adore him." But there's nothing like singing, "Oh, come let us adore him," in the place where he was actually born. And so that was an incredible highlight for us on our trip. One of the other real blessings that we had on our trip was I was able to bring my kids along with me, all except for Sam, who had finals. Sorry, Sam, that's what happens when you're still in college. Okay, hopefully that's what he was doing. Some of you guys know the feeling, right? And thanks, Nana, for paying their way to come and join us on this trip. So in Manger Square in Bethlehem, right across the street from the Church of the Nativity, here's how you celebrate Christmas. Cotton candy, right? Seems to make sense, right, for my grown kids to be eating cotton candy. Now, we're 12 days away, right? Christmas is going to happen 12 days from now. We're starting the 12 days of Christmas, which has nothing to do with the song. It's just the time where we are. And my question for us this morning to wrestle with is, how much effort and energy will go into over the next 12 days getting everything set for the secular celebration of Christmas? You say, "Tim, well, I don't celebrate the secular part of Christmas." Well, maybe you do. If you're putting up a tree and decorations, that wasn't part of the first Christmas. If you're buying presents for people, that wasn't part of the first Christmas. If you're putting together the right menu, that wasn't part of the first Christmas. Now, I'm not saying anything about that is wrong, but here's my concern. Here's the challenge I think we face as Americans living in a prosperous world. Here's what we are challenged with every single year. How much of our focus goes toward the traditions of a fun, exciting family celebration of Christmas, and how much of our focus is actually on the worship of Jesus and our hearts being wrapped up in the magnitude of this gift of God to us. So rather than us spending time this week talking about the events of the birth of Jesus, what I'd like us to do is talk about the implications of the birth of Jesus so that we may use this Sunday to prepare our hearts for receiving this incredible gift, Emmanuel, God with us, the gift of Jesus. And so we want to start off by looking at prophecy, a prophecy fulfilled. And I want to start with Jesus in his earthly ministry in the New Testament, and then we're going to go back to the Old Testament. So we're going to spend some time in Scripture today looking a little deeper than maybe what you're used to on Christmas. And so if you'll open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 4, Matthew chapter 4. Now let me bring you up to speed as where we are in the life of Jesus. Jesus grows up. It's time for him to start his earthly ministry. So he leaves Nazareth in the north. He travels south. When he gets south, he goes to the place where John is baptizing in the Jordan. He's baptized by John, and then he's immediately taken into the wilderness, tempted by Satan. For 40 days he fasts, and then he's tempted by Satan. He comes out of the wilderness only to hear that Herod has arrested John. And because the heat is so intense in the area at that point in time, Jesus then travels up the road by the Jordan River, goes up to the area of the Galilee, where he's going to really start his ministry at that point in time. And we pick that up in chapter 4, verse 12 of Matthew. It says, when Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he returned to Galilee. So he went to Galilee. First, he went to Nazareth. It says, leaving Nazareth, he went and lived in Capernaum. Now, what we know from the other Gospels is Jesus went to Nazareth. He opened the scroll of the book of Isaiah, which had a specific passage that prophesied about a coming Messiah. He read the passage about the Messiah. He sat down and he said, today, this prophecy is fulfilled in your hearing. And they tried to stone him to death in his hometown. So he leaves Nazareth and he comes to Capernaum, and it says he went and lived in Capernaum, which is by the lake. The lake there is the Sea of Galilee, in the area of Zebulun and Naphtali. Those are the two tribes of the 12 tribes that owned the property bordering the lake. And it says to fulfill what was said through the prophet Isaiah. Now here's the prophecy. Land of Zebulun, land of Naphtali, the way to the sea along the Jordan, Galilee of the Gentiles. The people living in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. From that time, Jesus began to preach, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is near. So this passage is telling us, Matthew's telling us, that where Jesus was and how he got there and what he was doing there is actually the fulfillment of a 700-year-old prophecy made by Isaiah. Now, we can say, well, isn't it coincidence? Maybe Jesus just ended up in the place and so forth. But it's beyond coincidence, because exactly the fulfillment, including being a light in a dark world, is fulfilled in the ministry of Jesus. In order to fully get this, I want us to jump back to Isaiah, to the prophecy itself, and look at how it's fulfilled. So if you'll jump back into the Old Testament, into the prophets, the big prophet Isaiah, prophesying 700 years before the birth of Jesus, is prophesying at a very dark time in the history of the nation. In fact, the history of the nation had already undergone civil war. It was divided, the 10 tribes in the north from the 2 tribes in the south. The 10 tribes in the north had already formed an alliance with one of the pagan kingdoms in the area. And the king in the south, Ahaz, who receives this prophecy, is in a really bad place. The kingdom that was arising at the time was Assyria, and I don't expect most of you know your ancient Near Eastern life, but Assyria makes ISIL look like a Sunday school picnic. They didn't behead people. That was too easy. What they did was they skinned people alive. They were one of the cruelest people on the planet. They were people that actually started the impaling that the Romans perfected, which became crucifixion. One of the first groups to really do that in a torturous way. And since these two tribes under King Ahaz didn't really stand a chance, Ahaz tried to broker a deal with them and said, can we become a vassal or serve under you for your protection and so that you won't kill us? And basically they said, oh yeah, you can. If you'll send us all your money, clear out the temple treasury, send us all your money, and if you'll stop worshiping Yahweh, shut down temple worship, and in its place put our gods, which required the sacrifice of infants. Can you imagine if you were living during that time? The king sent all the money away, so everybody's destitute. In addition to that, the king stops your ancestral worship. The God that you've given your life to shuts it down and begins to tell the moms, okay, I need a quota of babies to be sacrificed to these pagan gods. What was the mood of the people in Isaiah's time? Look at chapter 8, starting in verse 21. Distressed and hungry, they will roam through the land. When they are famished, they will become enraged, and looking upward will curse their king. Ahaz, how could you have done this to us? And their God. God, why have you forsaken us? Why have you left us in the dark? Then they will look toward the earth and see only distress and darkness and fearful gloom, and they will be thrust into utter darkness. Utter darkness is the place where there is no light. It's when there's no ray of hope coming in. This is the condition of the world of this prophecy 700 years before Jesus. Now watch what it says. Verse chapter 9, it says, nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali, but in the future, he will honor Galilee of the Gentiles by the way of the sea along the Jordan. Same words in the prophecy about Jesus' ministry. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light, and those living in the land of the shadow of death, a light has dawned. Now, what is the light? Verse 6 tells us, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. A child is going to be born who brings light into a dark world. Now, fast forward 700 years. During the time of Jesus, it was equally as dark. The religious leaders were fighting over scraps of power. There was huge division among the Jews. The Romans were ruling with an iron fist, exacting huge amounts of tribute. And the nation was on the verge of another attempt at civil war, which would actually be initiated in 68 AD. So Jesus is in 30 AD, 68 AD, like 38 years later. They're going to revolt, and when they revolt, Rome will come in, burn the city of Jerusalem, tear the temple down stone by stone, and crucify Jewish people up and down the roads until they run out of trees in the area to pin people up to. And in the midst of that, it says there is a light that shines in the darkness. Now let me show you the light. Jumping back to the New Testament, chapter 4 of Matthew. Jesus is in the area, a light shining, and it says, starting in verse 18, he picks his disciples, and then in verse 23, look it. Jesus went throughout Galilee, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the good news of the kingdom, and healing every disease and sickness among the people. News about him spread all over Syria, and people brought to him all who were ill with various diseases, those suffering severe pain and the demon-possessed, those having seizures and the paralyzed, and he healed them. Large crowds from the Galilee, the Decapolis, Jerusalem, Judea, and the region across the Jordan followed him. In the midst of this evil time, Jesus shows up and he's breaking the bondage of Satan. He's casting out demons. He's healing people with illnesses. He's fixing people that are broken. He's preaching about the kingdom of God and explaining it in a way that people are going, wow, I've never heard anything like this before. This is mind-blowing. And it says people from as far as Syria and as far as Jerusalem were bringing their sick to him to be healed. Now here's the question. How in the world did everybody find out about him? Because the place where we're talking about, the town of Capernaum there, is probably about 2,500 people. How's this happening? How's he becoming a light to all of these people? How's he bringing hope to all of these people? I mean, nobody's posting anything on Facebook. Nobody's got some YouTube videos that they're putting out about him, right? Here's what you get when you go to the Holy Land. You begin to see things take shape. So here's Capernaum. Here's the Sea of Galilee right here. Jordan River runs down here to the Dead Sea, dropping down from Caesarea here. You'd go south from here. You'd run into Jerusalem. And there is a highway, in fact, the biggest highway in the ancient world, running from Babylon through Damascus down to Jerusalem and all the way to Egypt. The main road that traveled, called the Via Maris, the way of the sea, and guess what it goes through? The town of Capernaum, where Jesus did 70% of his miracles, his recorded miracles. Now, if you lived in Damascus, and there were a group of people that were traveling this way, and they said, hey, you're not going to believe it, but we just passed through this little Jewish town by the Sea of Galilee, and there we met a guy who was healing people, who was teaching about how to have a relationship with God, a coming kingdom. If you had a sick relative, what would you do? You'd pack them up on your camel, and you'd bring them to Capernaum, right? If you lived in Jerusalem or even Egypt, you would come. In other words, this prophecy that in the middle of darkness, there was going to be this light that would shine in this particular region of the world was being fulfilled. 700-year-old prophecy. So, that's one. There are literally hundreds of those prophecies made in the Old Testament about the life of Jesus. So for those of you who are skeptical, let me just give you some information here. It might help you a bit. The oldest manuscript that we had of the Old Testament book of Isaiah was 1000 AD. And here's what the scholars and skeptics said. Those prophecies in Isaiah, they could not have been fulfilled with the precision that they were fulfilled with, so they were actually made up by the church. The church came along and made up those chapters and put them in the book of Isaiah, and that's why we have them in our manuscripts at 1000 AD. Here's the problem, skeptics. In 1946, a Bedouin boy walked into a cave and came out with the beginning of what became 10,000 scrolls that we now know as the Dead Sea Scrolls. A complete copy of the Isaiah scroll dating to 100 BC before Jesus, and the Isaiah scroll of 1000 AD and 100 BC were identical. So 100 years ago, if you would have sat in a class, you would have been taught that these prophecies were all fabricated after the fact to make it look like Jesus really did fulfill prophecy and he was the Son of God. And you may have sat in that class and you may have believed that and walked away from Christianity and said it's crazy, but you can't do that anymore. Because we've got the evidence to prove that that's not true. That's one prophecy. Again, there are hundreds of them. So when people say, well, you know, like Christianity, that's about faith. It's not about facts. It's not about reason. It's about faith. It's just a feeling. It's just what you want to believe. I would suggest to you that that's just a complete misunderstanding of reality. There are reasonable, grounded pieces of information that are historical in nature that make it reasonable to embrace the truth of the gospel and that Jesus Christ really existed and he really did the things that he was prophesied to do and recorded as doing. There's information here. Again, one more and a list of a bunch of them. So let's look at the promise itself. This promise kept. So jumping back to the book of Isaiah, what was prophesied about Jesus, starting in verse 6. Let's jump to verse 6 and we'll look at this promise that was made and kept by God. It says, "For to us a child is born, to us a son is given." Those are interesting phrases. Normally we think that a child is born to mom and dad, right? Child's born to mom and dad. This is saying that there's a child that's going to actually be born to the nation, to the people. It says a son is given. Implication, somebody else is going to give this child to the people. And the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. We'll come back to those in a minute. Of the increase of his government and peace, there will be no end. Implying that when Jesus starts his kingdom, it will continue to grow and continue to grow until it becomes endless, characterized by peace, harmony, shalom. We'll come back to that idea a little later. It says he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom. Everybody thought, well, how could that be? Because Israel wasn't a nation from 70 AD until, 1948. How did that happen? Just another one of those coincidences? And he will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. Now let's look carefully at what it's saying here. You see it, that it will be established with two guiding principles, and it will be kept. It will be held together by two guiding principles. Those two principles are justice and righteousness. Think this way. Justice means that everyone is being treated fairly. Righteousness means that everybody is acting rightly. Okay, treated fairly and everybody's acting rightly. If everybody's being treated fairly, then there'll never be a time when you're wondering, did I just get scammed, slammed, dissed? Can you imagine living in a world where those thoughts never went through your mind? Did somebody just take advantage of me? Because everybody's being treated fairly. A world of righteousness, when everybody's acting rightly, it will never go through your mind. I wonder what he was thinking. I wonder why she would do that. Those thoughts would never go through your mind. Because everyone would joyfully embrace a quality of existence, of behavior, and everybody would be treated fairly. Now, how do we know that this is going to come about? Well, watch what the prophecy says. It says that the zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. The word zeal means a fanatical passion. In other words, God is fanatically passionate about establishing a kingdom led by his son, Jesus Christ, on this planet where righteousness and justice will reign. That's what God is all about. And there are many prophecies pointing to the future when that's going to take place. Now, who can pull this off? Who can pull this off? Here's where we go to the description of Jesus. And in verse 6, we see this description laid out really clearly. This person revealed Jesus Christ. There's four descriptors of Jesus. And I want us to get those in our mind as we move into embracing Christmas this year. He says, for to us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will be called. In other words, this is what we would say about him when we encounter him. Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. So let's look at these one after another. First of all, Wonderful Counselor. I don't know about you, but when I hear the word counselor, I kind of have this Freudian thing, laying on the couch, somebody asking me about my relationship with my dad. Yeah, does anybody else conjure that up? It's kind of a personal, somebody helping you with your problems. That's not what this word means in the Hebrew. In the Hebrew, this word actually could be translated advisor. In other words, this is the person that advises based on their expertise and skill. So a government leader has a military advisor based on their knowledge and study of military activity, or an economic advisor based on their understanding of an economic theory. That's what this word actually means. That's what this word actually means. I read last month that in the U.S., we employ up to 70,000 right now, up to 70,000 advisors to advise our government in the various things that they need to do to get it right. 70,000. Your taxpayers are paying for those people to get the results that we're getting. Sorry, I just ruined your whole Christmas. Just think what could go under that tree if you had that money back, right? We laugh about that because we know that oftentimes the smartest human doesn't come up with very good advice. Or, in our case, they argue about what is right and wrong, even about the facts, and they never land on anything that makes any sense. That brings us to the first word, the word wonderful. Now, the word wonderful, when we say it, it's kind of a milquetoast word too, right? We say, oh, thank you so much for that fruitcake. It was wonderful. I know four of you like fruitcake. With that candy fruit sticking in your teeth. Yeah, I know. The word wonderful here is a word that actually means awe-inspiring. It inspires wonderment. In other words, when you hear the strategy that Jesus lays out for solving the problems of the world, your jaw will drop and you will go, wow, I've never heard that before. That's amazing. That will actually work. And so when we look at Jesus, the wonderful counselor, here's my term, jaw-dropping strategist. Now, when we think about the problems of the world, they're big problems, right? Think about this one, healthcare. How in the world could we find a way to provide healthcare for every person, at the same time ensure that they could get to the doctor that they needed to get to, that the quality of the doctors would be good, that the research and development would continue at the same rate, that people could actually afford it, and we didn't break the country's budget in doing that. You'd say, well, whoever comes up with that, man, that would be unbelievable, right? Exactly. You can't wait until you see Jesus care. You're going to go, whoa, that's unbelievable. But that's what this passage is saying. Jesus understands how to solve the problems of the world. So let me ask you this Christmas. Do you think the problem that you're facing right now is something that Jesus doesn't understand? That he's not wise enough to navigate you through it? That's what Christmas is. It's meeting a wonderful counselor. The second description in the passage is mighty God. Now, there are lots of people with a lot of ideas, but the ability to pull it off requires somebody who's divine. And this passage reminds us that Jesus is none other than fully deity. He is God incarnate. He is limitless in his ability. Do you feel like there's a problem in your life that Jesus can't, through his power, get you through? That's why we're celebrating Christmas. Nothing under your tree will solve your problems. It doesn't have the power to do that. But Jesus does. The third description, this may be my favorite of all. It's everlasting Father. The idea of everlasting is that Jesus has existed before time. As the second person of the Trinity, he was here when the world came together, when humanity was created. Jesus knows how things work. And Jesus will be here forever. But his relationship to you is beyond a king or lord subject relationship. Jesus calls us his friends. He's building a family. That's why his leadership will be wise and loving like a father. Some of you feel terribly alone right now. And you're walking into your celebration of Christmas thinking, I don't know that anybody is paying any attention to my life. Jesus is a Father who is with you before he came into existence and will be with you in eternity. He'll never leave us or forsake us. That's who Jesus is. You're never alone. At Christmas of all times, you ought to recognize you're never alone because God has sent his Son to be like a father to you. The final description that the prophet gives here, I love this. Prince of Peace calls this the Master of Harmony. The word peace is the word shalom. It doesn't just mean fixing the conflict. It means taking all the parts and bringing out the best in them so that they enhance each other. Can you imagine what would happen if everybody in humanity put together their best self to work together in harmony rather than in competitive tearing one another apart? Jesus is going to make that happen. All of the brilliance of the creatives and the engineers, all the brilliance of the compassionate and the organized, and all the brilliance of humanity coming together in harmony, and not only just with each other, but with God himself, so that all of the benefits of the Godhead and all the benefits of humanity are working in perfect harmony, and then bring nature into that. What a dynamic world. It will be like the individual pieces of an orchestra. And Jesus, as the conductor, will play all of creation and humanity and the Godhead in the most beautiful harmony. I don't know what the tune in your life sounds like, whether it's discordant this year or not. I don't know. But Jesus was born to bring harmony into your world. So, can I just have a pastoral moment with you right now? Here's the tension. Here's what most of us, I think, feel. We feel like if the people that we love are loving us well and we're hanging together pretty well at Christmas time and our financial situation is such that we can afford to spoil each other a little bit and we're all in pretty good health and we get the decorations up without killing each other, and the menu's coming together and people are not complaining so much about what the main course is going to be. It's kind of working. And those who we love that are far away can come and see us or we can go see them. Then this is going to be a good Christmas. But if one of those things or all of those things are out of whack, then we feel like God, what are you doing? You're robbing the joy of my Christmas. Here's what I'm wondering. If the people that are in the deepest, darkest depression shouldn't be having the greatest experience at Christmas, because every piece of clutter has been stripped away and they can focus exclusively on the hope that Jesus has come into the world for you and that he will never leave you and never forsake you, and no matter what goes wrong in the world in which you live, you can celebrate Christmas with a full heart of joy. Because believe me, there are Christians all over this planet that will never have a tree, much less put a present under a tree, that are jumping up and down on Christmas morning rejoicing because their hope is in Jesus, not in the celebration. And what I fear is we've taken the celebration and we've used it as a replacement for the real thing. And it will never be the real thing. And so my prayer for you is that all that stuff, those are just decorations. But that you and the people that you love would gather around the centrality of the promise and the blessing, which is Jesus himself. Because if you have Jesus, is there anything else you need? Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. In order to focus totally on him, we're going to pause now and we're going to receive communion. So I'd like us to bow our heads as the servers make their way to prepare to serve us communion. Let's bow our heads together and prepare our hearts. Father in heaven, we just praise you for the gift of your Son, Jesus. In this moment, we pray that you would remove all of our introspection, our frustrations, our disappointments, and may truly our focus and our hope be on your Son, Jesus Christ. May we remember that what started in a manger ended in an empty tomb. And the security of our hope is forever established because of the sacrifice of your Son, Jesus. Fill us with a reminder that people waited and waited and waited for that day. And we wait for a day coming when we'll see your Son face to face. Invite the servers to make their way to the front, and we ask you to hold the bread and the cup, and we'll receive them all together in a moment. Join us as we worship.